From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
Can the executive, under the United States Constitution, can it place itself above and beyond and outside and in violation of the United States Constitution?
Today we speak with Oscar award-winning actor Vanessa Redgrave about justice and Guantanamo for the detainees. We'll also speak with the lawyer for the Haitian government, who's just served papers asking the U.S. to prosecute those involved with President Aristide and his wife's alleged kidnapping. And Laura Flanders, author of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, Part 2.
When George and Dick are in trouble, their women hit the campaign trail. They want your votes, but beware the Bushwomen. There are things in their past you don't know.
We'll look at Secretary of the Interior Gail Ann Norton, who once fought to legalize marijuana and for equal rights for gay men and lesbians. We'll look at Condoleezza Rice, Karen Hughes, Elaine Chao, Christine Todd Whitman, Ann Veneman, and Lynn Cheney, wife of the vice president, who once published a steamy novel celebrating free love and lesbian romance. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Controversy over Iraq's new interim constitution continued Monday even after the 25 members of the U.S.-appointed Iraqi Governing Council signed the U.S.-approved constitution. Iraq's leading Shiite cleric, Ayatollah Sistani, said interim document minders hinders democracy and gives the Kurds enough power to thwart passage of a permanent constitution. Meanwhile, 12 of the 13 Shiites on the governing council, including Ahmed Chalabi, signed a statement saying they intended to amend key portions of the document they considered to be undemocratic. The Los Angeles Times reports five Shiite leaders refused to attend the signing ceremony in protest. In Kirkuk, tens of thousands of Kurds took to the streets to celebrate the signing of the new interim constitution, claiming that, in effect, it returned Kirkuk to Kurdistan. But according to the Guardian of London, the huge outpouring of Kurdish emotion disregarded the fact that the constitution does not rule definitively on the future of the contested city, the surrounding areas, and their vast oil wealth. One Western official said, quote, "They're going to have a nasty hangover when they wake up in the morning. They clearly have not read the new law carefully enough." Meanwhile, Turkish officials have protested the new constitution for giving too much autonomy to the Kurds. Turkey's justice minister said, quote, "The interim law does not satisfy us. It increases our concerns. We see it as an arrangement that will not help the establishment of permanent peace in Iraq." In Haiti, a council of sages has formed to put together a transitional government to pick a replacement to Aristide's prime minister, Yvonne Neptune. On Monday, Boniface Alexandre was officially installed as the country's interim president. But ousted President Jean-Bertrand Aristide maintained yesterday he was still president. Lawyers representing Aristide are planning to serve Secretary of State General Colin Powell with papers today, asking the U.S. to prosecute the people involved in what they call the kidnapping of Aristide and his wife, Mildred, who is a U.S. citizen. Meanwhile, in Washington, State Department spokesman Richard Boucher dismissed Aristide's charge that he was kidnapped or his claim to the presidency. Boucher said, quote, "If Mr. Aristide really wants to serve his country, he really has to, we think, let his nation get on with the future and not try to stir up the past again." On the campaign front, President Bush yesterday blasted Senator John Kerry for proposing to reduce the intelligence budget by $1.5 billion in 2 years after the first World Trade Center attack. Kerry's campaign defended the move, saying the cut targeted a slush fund for defense contractors. A Kerry spokesperson said, quote, "Unlike George Bush, John Kerry does not and will not support every special spending project supported by Halliburton and other defense contractors. Meanwhile, Kerry campaigned in Florida ahead of Tuesday's primary. According to the Boston Globe, the senator came closer than he ever has before in questioning the legitimacy of Bush's elected hold on the White House. He said, quote, "You'd think that somebody, remembering what happened here in this great state, who was finally put in office by the Supreme Court of the United States, would actually recognize the division of the nation and try to reach out. But oh no, they shut the doors on Democrats, my way or the highway, on this policy or that policy, misled America time and again," unquote. Kerry also announced he was putting together a legal team to monitor voting districts in Florida that reported problems in 2000. His campaign also plans to pre-challenge any irregularities it suspects in the balloting process. The New York Times is reporting that over the last several decades, the U.S. has given a total of 43 countries enough uranium, weapons-grade uranium to make 1,000 nuclear bombs. Much of the uranium was loaned, leased, or sold starting in the 1950s under President Eisenhower's Atoms for Peace program. Countries included Pakistan and Iran. A new Energy Department audit found the U.S. is making little effort to recover the large quantities of weapon-grade uranium that it has dispersed. Officials in Zimbabwe reported yesterday they seized a U.S.-registered cargo plane carrying 64, quote, suspected mercenaries and military equipment. The Los Angeles Times has learned that Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia gave a keynote dinner speech in Philadelphia for an advocacy group waging a legal battle against gay rights at a time that the Supreme Court was weighing a landmark gay rights case last year. A month after the dinner, he dissented from a decision that overturned a Texas law made sex between same-sex couples a crime. A new study by the Air Force found there were at least 92 reports of rape involving Air Force personnel in the Pacific between 2001 and 2003. The internal report criticized flaws in the reporting system of sexual assault claims and assistance provided to victims. Attorney General John Ashcroft remains in intensive care 5 days after being diagnosed with a severe case of gallstone pancreatitis. Meanwhile, Congressmember and presidential candidate Dennis Kucinich was hospitalized Monday with an intestinal ailment. And the actor, writer, and monologuist Spalding Gray has died. His body was found this weekend floating in New York's East River. He had disappeared on January 10th. It's believed he committed suicide. Janara Bell here on Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Lawyers representing Haitian President Jean-Bertrand Aristide today are serving Secretary of State General Colin Powell with papers asking that the U.S. prosecute the people involved in what they call the kidnapping of Jean-Bertrand Aristide and his wife Mildred, who is a U.S. citizen. The lawyers are invoking the Multilateral Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crimes Against Internationally Protected Persons. The request that the United States fulfill its obligations under the convention stems from what Aristide's lawyers call the intentional commission of internationally recognized crimes that were, quote, part of a coup d'etat organized and implemented by officials of the government of the United States of America to remove and replace the democratically elected president of Haiti. The demand specifically references the kidnapping of Aristide while on board an aircraft belonging in whole or in part to the United States. In a letter to Attorney General John Ashcroft, Aristide's lawyers said, quote, "These criminal acts appear to have been carried out by the U.S. government personnel acting under the orders of high-ranking United States government officials, including the United States Deputy Chargé de Mission in Haiti, Luis Moreno, and possibly Assistant Secretary of State Roger Noriega, who is head of the Bureau of Western Hemisphere Affairs, Secretary of State Colin Powell, and Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld." Aristide's lawyers are also calling on the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights to initiate a fact-finding mission in Haiti to investigate what they say are summary executions and continued violence against Lavalas supporters. We're joined by Ira Kurzban, who is a Miami-based lawyer. Since 91, he served as the general counsel for the government of Haiti. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Ira Kurzban.
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Well, can you explain what this lawsuit is all about?
Well, there's actually three separate actions, Amy. The first, as you pointed out, was a request, which is part of the Multilateral Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of Crimes Against Internationally Protected Persons, in this case, President Aristide and his wife, who was the First Lady, to initiate a process that would ultimately go before the International Court of Justice. In order to initiate that process, you must serve the state parties, in this case, of course, the United States, and that's why it's going to Colin Powell, to give the United States an opportunity to initiate domestically those prosecutions of persons before we go to the International Court of Justice. The United States has a certain period of time in which to address these wrongs and to respond, and if they fail to do so within a certain period of time, then we can go to the International Court of Justice, and that's what we intend to do.
How do you intend to serve General Colin Powell papers?
We serve him today by mail, and I'm sure they will have received it at the State Department this morning. And the second thing that we requested was a direct request to the Attorney General of the United States to initiate prosecution under various federal statutes, because kidnapping, as you know, of course, is a federal crime. And in the implementation of this multilateral convention, a number of our own domestic statutes were changed to make it a federal crime to kidnap a internationally protected person. And, of course, here we have the added dimension that Mrs. Aristide is a United States citizen. So what we have is a kidnapping of a United States citizen by United States government officials. That's a serious crime, obviously, not only international law, but under our own domestic law. And therefore, we are calling upon the Attorney General to conduct an investigation and to prosecute those individuals. And if that involves the Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld and involves the Secretary of State Powell, then I think that's his obligation to do so.
Let's play a clip of what General Colin Powell, the Secretary of State, had to say when confronted with the allegations of kidnapping by the U.S. and this being a coup d'etat that has removed President Aristide and the First Lady Mildred Aristide.
He was not kidnapped. We did not force him onto the airplane. He went onto the airplane willingly. And that's the truth.
Your response, Ira Kurzban.
Well, if that's the truth, then certainly Secretary Powell and the President of the United States should be willing to have an investigation of this. They have nothing to hide. You know, it's the classic situation where if you really have nothing to hide and, you know, you believe that everything was done properly, let the Congress of the United States investigate this. Let the CARICOM countries, through the Organization of American States, as they have requested, investigate this. And let the whole world know exactly what we did. You know, the secretary getting up and giving kind of a bald-faced denial, I hope doesn't satisfy the American people. I hope we've learned from the weapons of mass destruction claim and other things that this administration and particularly Secretary Powell have claimed need to be looked at further. So in this case, you know, I suppose the secretary can say what he wants, but if we're serious about it, we should have an investigation.
And right now, who is calling for that investigation in Congress?
Various members have called for it. A number of members of the Black Caucus, Congressman Rangel, Congresswoman Waters, Congresswoman Lee, and others have said we need to have a full-scale investigation of what happened here. And the problem is, of course, you know, the Republicans control both houses of Congress and probably don't want the truth to come out. But my hope is that there will be enough concern about this issue and enough public outcry that we investigate whether or not our administration was involved in the a coup d'etat against a democratically elected president in this hemisphere. That's a very serious allegation, and I haven't made that allegation lightly, but I think we have enough facts to establish that. But I think the Congress needs to swear these people under oath, take their testimony, and investigate it.
And the status of Boniface Alexander, who has been sworn in as the interim president, as well as the Council of Sages now choosing a replacement for the prime minister, Yvonne Neptune?
The president of the Republic of Haiti yesterday spoke, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. He said he is still the president, that there was a coup d'etat, that whatever process is going on in Port-au-Prince, which, by the way, actually is the process that the opposition asked for during that week of negotiations prior to the actual coup, the process that's being implemented now is actually the opposition's proposal. It's not the CARICOM proposal, as the United States has said. So what we have is the opposition in Haiti determining a series of events that are ongoing and that are excluding, of course, the major political party in the country, which is Lavalas.
We'll end today with the words of President Aristide in Democracy Now!'s interview with the Haitian president yesterday in the Central African Republic, just after he had held a news conference that has gotten very little coverage. This is Jean-Bertrand Aristide.
First of all, I didn't leave Haiti because I wanted to leave Haiti. They forced me to leave Haiti. It was a kidnapping, which they call coup d'etat, or for some others, nothing else than something which is resignation. For me, it wasn't a resignation. It's a real kidnapping under the cover of coup d'etat.
He said this is a kidnapping under the cover of a coup d'etat. And this is Democracy Now! If you want to read the transcript of that half-hour interview or listen to it online, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. This is the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now, here at home, to the administration, specifically to the women of the administration. Secretary of the Interior Gail Ann Norton once fought to legalize marijuana and for equal rights for gay men and lesbians. National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice has publicized that her father voted Republican. He also spoke out against the Vietnam War and brought a number of interesting figures to his university, Denver University, including Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan and the South African poet Dennis Brutus. Karen Hughes, still one of the president's closest advisors, says she would have loved to do public relations for Exxon after the Exxon Valdez oil spill. Her father was the last U.S. governor of the Panama Canal Zone. We're going to look at Labor Secretary Elaine Chao. Christine Todd Whitman, the former director of the EPA, Agriculture Secretary Ann Veneman, and Lynn Cheney, the wife of the vice president, the darling of conservatives, who once wrote a steamy lesbian love novel. That's all coming up when we speak to radio host and author Laura Flanders, author of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, when we come back.
Throw back your head and roll up your sleeve. Defend your convictions through all kinds of frictions. Give more than you'll ever receive. Cause freedom never comes free. No, no, no. It never comes free. No, no, no. You think
comes freedom.
Never comes free. No, 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 it never comes free. When it's your turn, you learn freedom is something you earn.
You gotta really,
really
care for what you believe. Throw back your head and roll up your sleeve. Defend your convictions through all kinds of
This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, and today we talk about Bushwomen, tales of a cynical species. Coming up, we'll be joined by Vanessa Redgrave, who has spent this weekend in Washington, D.C., protesting the detention without trial of the Guantanamo prisoners. And we'll talk about that in a little while. But right now, Laura Flanders, author of Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species, part two of our radio interview. Welcome, Laura.
Good to be back, Amy.
It's good to have you with us to really go through the women of the Bush administration. Laura Flanders, for those of you who don't know, is host of Your Call, which is heard on KALW-FM in San Francisco and on the internet as well. Author of Bushwomen. Well, why don't you tell us some of these intriguing stories that you dug up as you profiled the women of the Bush administration?
Well, there's no end of them, really. But listening to the coverage from Haiti, what I'm so struck by is this is an administration engaged in some very sinister operations. And what we're seeing in the public eye, and what we've seen from the get-go, is this kind of multi-culti facade that leads people to think that this isn't sinister right-wing cabal running the country. There are women there. There are people of color there. And people may remember right after the inauguration, the naming of Ann Veneman to head up the agriculture department, of Gail Norton to head up interior, of Elaine Chao to labor and so forth. The media went crazy. The Washington Post said the face of the Republican Party had been changed. Suddenly a cabinet that looks like America. It looks a little like America, but it is deep in its political history. Funnily enough, the mainstream media, when they see women and people of color, tend not to really dig deep into the political past. What we get instead are their personal stories.
Are you suggesting that people look rather than listen at the Bush women?
I think there is a manipulation of stereotypes. Look at Elaine Chao, a woman who came to this country age 8 from Taiwan, not speaking a word of English. That much we've heard. She rose to the high ranks of power in the United States as if to suggest that anybody and everybody could do that. And this is an argument that she used, actually, when she was a member of the Independent Women's Forum in the 1990s campaigning against affirmative action. She was, you know, your classic model minority character who suggested, if I can do it, everyone can do it. But there's a little bit more to her history that we need to know. Her family are very well connected. Her father was a shipper, is a shipper, with personal ties to Jiang Zemin of China. His trade grew as Henry Kissinger brought down the barriers between the United States and China. And she attended Mount Holyoke, the Ivy League college. She grew up in a leafy Queens suburb of New York, where she describes helping her father pave the horseshoe driveway. She had to petition him, please, to let her have a summer job. She studied a golf course, and she took golf at Mount Holyoke. Good for her. I spoke to somebody who took the class with her. All fair enough, but don't tell us you're a part of your personal story and let that suggest that you have some insight into, you know, the poor immigrant populations in this country. She has insight, but I don't think it's quite where most people suspect. You push the button, the stereotype kind of plays in people's mind. Chinese immigrant, they think sweatshops, they think Chinese takeout stores. It's a little different. She's now married to one of the most powerful people in the administration, in the Republican Party, Mitch McConnell. The conflicts of interest, I think, are rank. She's the head of the Mine Safety Administration, part of the Labor Department that is supposed to watch out for miners and make sure that mines are safe. And we remember that horrible disaster with those miners caught underground in Pennsylvania. It was a non-union mine working illegally. Her husband is the Kentucky senator, receives a lot of money from mining corporations. Is there a conflict of interest there? That's the kind of story I want reporters to look at, not just how great it was that she learned English so fast and rose so far.
What about Karen Hughes?
What about Karen Hughes?
Well, and the position she plays today.
Now she's back as an official spokesperson for the administration and for George W. Bush. And it's been she out there responding to the families of 9/11 who were offended and hurt to the quick by the manipulation of images from the tragedy of 9/11 in the very first campaign ad. She had the gall, I think, to take to the television and suggest that these were not really people with credibility. These were not really people with standing. I think it's easier for her to do that than it would be for Dick Cheney to do that, for George Bush himself to do that. She's played this role from the beginning. When the Bush campaign of 1994, going back to the governorship of Texas, needed to go up against Ann Richards, one of the most popular Democratic governors of the day, a rising star in the Democratic Party, they needed a woman to go up against Ann Richards, who had won a lot of the women's vote, even the Republican women's vote. And Karen Hughes was there. She was put in the position of the chair of the Republican Party. She every day mobilized Republicans to snipe at every action that Ann Richards took. She and Karl Rove pioneered in 94 a kind of campaigning where George W. Bush would say the same thing on the campaign trail every single day. And we saw that again in 2000. She would stand at the back of the hall and literally cut off the press conferences when she thought they were getting too close to the bone. She supports an administration that is aggressively anti-affirmative action, that is aggressively for rolling back protections for women and people of color in the workplace. But I suggest that she first got her first job in 1977, in part thanks to the National Organization for Women. That was the year that the networks were under pressure to enforce affirmative action mandates. The federal government had mandated them to do as they were told. They'd been in violation. They'd been sued under the Equal Employment Opportunity Laws of the 1970s. She had the women's movement, the law, the federal government at her back when she walked in the door of Channel 5, an NBC affiliate in Dallas, and was looking for a job. The best ever year for women and people of color to get a job in the networks. Most of the people that got a job then, Judy Woodruff, Barbara Walters, are still the people that you see on TV today. The cynicism is that these women advanced thanks to laws that they are now trying to repeal, and that's where I think they need to be called to account.
Very interesting, her family history and the role of her father in U.S. history.
She grew up, and we've heard that she was an army brat. Well, it's not quite, again, the story that you imagine of being dragged from place to place. Sure enough, she did stay a lot of time in different bases, but her father was one of the top people in the Panama Canal Zone, ultimately the last governor, and he was the man whose job it became to pull down the U.S. flag. And as you recall or have read, you're so young, the 1970s fight over the Panama Canal was the fight in the Republican Party. It was the issue against which Republicans campaigned against Jimmy Carter, that he was going to sign a pact that would ultimately hand over power of the canal to the Panamanian people. That was the dividing line political issue in that election. Her father was deeply involved in the sense that he was the man who ultimately had to pull down that flag, a sign of tremendous ignominy. She grew up, she spent many years in the Panama Canal Zone, a very segregated place. I think she takes these issues of American empire very personally.
You also say Karen Hughes says she would have loved to do PR for Exxon after the Exxon Valdez.
I found that quote. I thought that was worth repeating. She's a PR person. She sees it as war. She says, I look at PR as a war game. And she was asked, you know, are there any PR campaigns you wish you'd had as your, you know, in your contract? She said she would have liked to represent Exxon after the Exxon Valdez spill. So I think she found the right job.
I wonder if at any point she feels like she's in that situation again.
Well, she might, and she's probably enjoying every minute of it. She's brilliant at what she does. I mean, the women in the book, some of them I came away with more respect than others. Karen Hughes is brilliant at what she does, and she helped to elect this president as no other individual. And while I think Karl Rove deserves a lot of credit too, Karen Hughes really pioneered during the election campaign the with us or against us motif, that you were either on our side or the side of the enemy. The enemy in the 99-2000 race were reporters who asked tough questions, were reporters who raised questions of the candidate's drunk driving convictions, the candidate's absent without leave, it seems, not turning up for the National Guard duty he was supposed to turn up for, who raised those questions, you were off the bus. And in so doing, she created a very comfortable situation for the candidate. If all of those who will ask difficult questions are banished, then the environment, the climate on the bus can be very warm and friendly and collegial, as every journalist who was there describes it. Bush had this relaxed, very friendly relationship with journalists. Why? Because his pit bull, Karen Hughes, was at the door keeping anyone who would cause trouble out.
We're talking to Laura Flanders, and Laura is the radio host of Your Call on KALW in San Francisco. She has written a new book called Bush Women, Tales of a Cynical Species, and last night you launched the book in New York at a raucous, rowdy theater production of parts of the book in which the beginning was a reading by Condoleezza Rice.
It's nice of her to show up, don't you think?
Was played by Jill Nelson, talking about her father, and then having the speech, one of the speeches of actually Condoleezza Rice's father. Talk about
it. It was quite chilling. I mean, A, it's chilling to go back and listen to these speeches. I mean, Jill did a fantastic job in twinset and pearls and a wig and the stockings and comfortable shoes, the whole nine yards. Thank you, Jill. Charles Turner, who recently played King Lear at Yale, he came forward and read an account of a demonstration on the campus of Denver University in 1971, May, a year after the police killings of anti-war activists at Kent State and civil rights activists at Jackson State. The account is chilling, too, because you hear Condoleezza describe her father as a Republican, the first Republican she ever knew, and talk about her own family to explain why she joined this party that stands for peace and security and all good things. He participated in a rally where he looked out to the crowd and he said, I look at you, you are the capitalists of tomorrow, you are the politicians of tomorrow, I ask you, will you be the perpetrators of war or of peace? Are you going to be the agents of a long and lasting change that makes this country an agent of war or of peace, or did your brothers and sisters at Kent State and Jackson State die in vain? Chilling, because Condoleezza Rice has become all those things. A politician, a businesswoman. She was on the board of Chevron. An educator. She was the provost at Stanford. And now a person with tremendous political power. Has she been an agent of war or of peace? Well, I answered that question, or tried to, by talking to the women of Nigeria, whom I know you know, from the Niger Delta, who throughout the 1990s were petitioning the shareholders of Chevron to review their relationship, at the very least, with the dictatorship of Sani Abacha, who were on the receiving end of the devastation of the environment, of their neighborhoods, by the oil companies, Chevron, Shell, and the rest, who ultimately saw their own community members shot down by agents of the state working for the corporations. Shareholders petitioned the board throughout the 1990s. There were those shareholder initiatives. And throughout the 1990s, while Condoleezza Rice sat on the Social Policy Committee of Chevron, there were only six people on the committee, she would turn away those resolutions. We won't even consider them. We won't even put them forward for consideration by the full board, because corporations do not pick and choose which countries they deal with. We are bringing development to those countries in the long run. That's her view. She's entitled to it, but the public is entitled to know that about her history, particularly when she presents herself as a kind of civil rights paragon. Hmm.
Folks actually can go to our website at democracynow.org and link to the documentary that Jeremy Scahill and I did on the killing in Nigeria that Chevron was involved with, this altering the directorship of Condoleezza Rice on the board of Chevron. It's called Drilling and Killing Chevron in Nigeria's Oil Dictatorship at democracynow.org. She also had an oil tanker named
after her. Condoleezza Rice. And people, the reason this is important is that when Dick Cheney takes to the television screen, at this point he reads visually as oil man. People can almost see the contracts in Iraq sprouting out of his head. You see Halliburton. He can't go anywhere in the country without alarm-sounding reporters covering his presence. Condoleezza Rice takes to the television and addresses the people and says, as she did in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq, this is the civil rights issue of our day, to bring democracy to the people of the Iraqi nation. And she reads in a whole different way. And I suggest that's part stereotype, that we still live in a very stereotyped country and media, and we don't imagine that she is really oil man. But it's also the failure of the media, I think, to fill out the picture beyond what she's cared to share.
Christine Todd Whitman, no longer with the EPA, head of the EPA.
Well, as you remember, when she was appointed, that was the sign that the administration was open to liberal views. Why liberal? Because she was pro-choice. We have a media in this country that defines liberalism or conservatism on social issues, not on financial issues, not on economics. If you look at her economic record in the state of New Jersey, where she'd been governor before she joined this administration, her record was second to none when it came to slashing taxes. She was the darling of the Republican convention in 94 because she had been the first to make the promise that she would cut taxes and carry through in 96. I'm sorry. She came to power making a promise to slash taxes in a way that no governor ever had. She was able to do it. That's what got her the support of the Republican Party. And she co-chaired that convention, as you may remember, with another very popular up-and-coming Republican governor, George W. Bush. And at that convention, she helped to silence the voices of pro-choice Republicans who wanted to say there was room in the party for pro-choicers, too. She, even on the issue that she became famous as a progressive, as a liberal, as a social moderate, even on that issue, she wouldn't stand up. This is a woman whose history on the environment, you'll hear about, yes, she granted a billion-dollar bail issue to protect open space in New Jersey. You'll hear about that. But those are the green kind of open space issues. When it comes to the brown issues of the inner city and watchdogging corporations and how they affect neighborhoods and pollute communities, she opened the door to corporations. She established an ombudsman specifically for the business community to help them, as she put it, navigate the state's environmental protection laws, even as she cut the budget for the public's ombudsman.
And then, of course, there was the cover-up of 911. One and the environment
that's
right
whole,
here at Ground Zero.
Exactly, and that's a story that Juan Gonzalez, your co-host, has covered extensively, and good for him. She came out days, really the very same day of 9/11, and was saying, we believe the air is safe to breathe and the water is safe to drink. 2 days later, came to the city, confirmed that view, very reassuring, and luckily, just luck would have it, sent a message to the Wall Street stockbrokers that Wall Street was safe to open. It wasn't safe. Talk to anybody at the EPA. They have protocols that in a standard situation would have required the whole neighborhood to be evacuated until they could ascertain whether it was actually safe for humans to be here. That wasn't possible. You couldn't keep Wall Street shut for any longer than it had been shut. The economy was really facing a serious crisis. Her coming forward and saying it's safe, when her scientists were saying, we don't know that. How could anybody know that? We've never been in a situation like this before. At least say we don't know. At least say we can't assure you of anything. No, she came forth. She said it's safe. She played a political role. Now she will say, yes, the White House played a role in that. But she's now left the administration. She still has nothing bad to say about how they undertook their economic policy, their environmental policy, except for perhaps they didn't attend to appearances in the way that they should.
And, of course, the memo came out from the White House that was suppressing the information,
exactly,
ordering the EPA to do that. We're going to end with, I want to get everyone in here.
Read the book.
So that'll be a tease for people to actually read Bush Women, because it's not only about these women. It really is a way that you have illustrated the whole Bush administration. But last night, you did a reading of, or the actors there did a reading of Liz Cheney's book, Sisters. Can you talk about this? Liz Cheney, wife of the vice president.
The Liz Cheney players are taking to the stage. I think they're going to be coming to the conventions. They did an extraordinary job, Lois Weaver, Carmelita Tropicana, Maggie Moore. Indeed, people may remember after 9/11, somebody was drawing up a list of who was patriotic and who wasn't. It was the American Association of Alumna, a group founded by Liz Cheney. It was in keeping with her history as a culture warrior since the 1990s when she headed up the National Endowment for the Humanities. She's been the sort of moral arbiter of who receives government funding and who is accepted as politically correct, politically incorrect. She was also part of the whole campaign to belittle political correctness and complain that feminists were taking over campuses and that people of color were destroying the canon. How did she get this standing as culture warrior, as arbiter of morality in the United States? Well, on the basis that she was a published author. Well, we went to look for what she'd actually published. And turns out that at the time she was appointed to the NEH, she'd published two novels. One, Executive Privilege, a kind of not very good suspense novel set in Washington. The second was this book, Sisters, that came out in 1981 in kind of gothic paperback, Signet classic. I found a copy after much searching. And it is a romance set in late 19th century Wyoming that looks at, you know, the close relationships between women. And there are women in the book that articulate, you know, why are our relationships not taken seriously, that talk about the passion they have for one another. The other more interesting character is really the Lynn Cheney character in the book. The protagonist has run away from the church school, run away from the convent to go and join the musical theater. And she travels the country with a musical theater troupe led by a very charismatic woman who is a big advocate of free love and who takes her aside and says, you're very beautiful, you are going to have a lot of relationships with men, but don't be caught by men, don't be trapped by them, and this is how you can avoid being trapped. And she presents her with a lacquered box filled with condoms, basically, and other preventive devices. And there's a strong message in the book that women can enjoy sex without getting pregnant and having children if they can have the protection that comes with contraception. That's the Lynn Cheney position in 1981. Now she's part of an administration that is denying condoms to people who need them for HIV prevention in countries all around the world. She's part of an administration that is making the opposite argument for what her character Sophie made in 1981. She may want to come forward and say, I've completely changed my views, but don't just drop this book off your official White House biography, as you have done. Don't pretend you didn't once hold those views, and explain how you've changed those views. If you were then an advocate of free love and of condoms, and if you understood the importance, and this book is, her novel is not beautifully written, but the message is pretty clear that condoms can liberate women from this sort of war of the sexes, as she describes it.
It's also
explain to us what happened.
It's also a steamy lesbian love novel.
It's hysterical. I mean, it's hysterical. It's silly. She says no more than 50 people ever read it. It's worth reading just to realize these people who now cast themselves up as having this strong moral compass, right v. left, right v. wrong, and right v. left, perhaps, have a far more checkered past.
But it's not just that, is she painted with the same brush as the administration? She herself is one of the leading conservatives. When you have someone, she represents the right wing of the Republican Party.
The two wives perform that function. Lynn Cheney represents the right. She's the culture warrior for the hawks. Laura Bush represents the social moderates, and they send her out onto the campaign trail to kind of woo the social moderate voters who are going to be critical in this election.
I was fascinated to read about George Bush Sr. in your book, and Barbara, and their view on abortion before they were against it.
When he was a congressman, he was called Rubbers. He was so in favor of government-sponsored distribution of contraception. She was a big funder of Planned Parenthood. The point here is that these people are cynical hypocrites after power. They will change their position for political reasons, and their policies are driven by interests in profit, in self-advancement, not necessarily the good of the country. In many cases, they've completely switched their views when it comes to what serves the public interest. And that's one good example. When he was up against Ronald Reagan in the presidential campaign of 1980, he needed to be as right-wing as Reagan was, and he abandoned pro-choice Republican women who had brought him to that point in the campaign, and they're still steaming over that.
Well, Laura Flanders, I wish we could go on, but we have to break and go on to Vanessa Redgrave, who is in town in the United States to deal with the issue of detainees on Guantanamo. Laura Flanders' book is Bushwomen, Tales of a Cynical Species. It is a fascinating book, and she may be coming to a city near you. You're embarking
March 18th in San Francisco. We're going to do a very similar theater event. If you're in San Francisco, March 18th at the Brava Theater.
And you're not only there, you're in Los Angeles and other places, so you can check Laura's website at lauraflanders.com. Thanks very much for joining us. It's great being your neighbor on the other side of Ground Zero.
Thank
for folks listening to the coughing in the background, that Sharif, I don't know if it's any accident that our producer, Sharif Abdelkaddous, is the one who lives closest to Ground Zero. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, Vanessa Redgrave. Thanks, Laura. This is Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Five British detainees held for 2 years at Guantanamo, Cuba, as terrorism suspects, are due to return home today. The men, whose release was announced last month, are likely to be set free after being questioned by anti-terror police in Britain. Well, there's a new commission that has been set up by individuals, the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission, made up of family members and supporters of the detainees who traveled to Washington this weekend, hoping to meet with President Bush. Had to settle for a march on the White House. Vanessa Redgrave was among them. She joined us in our studio just before going down to Washington to talk about the situation of the detainees. Vanessa Redgrave, an Oscar-winning actor, longtime activist. During her acting career, which has spanned close to half a century, she served as UN Goodwill Ambassador and was member of the International Artists Against Racism. I began by asking about her trip to the United States and the issue of the Guantanamo detainees.
Well, as you know, we are all very concerned in Britain with the fact that there are 9 British detainees in Guantanamo and that our government has not stood up for international law and the European Human Rights Convention, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, or the Universal Declaration for Human Rights, or the 3rd or 4th Geneva Convention, and insisted on the return of the British detainees. And I would say, you know, the highest legal authorities, including the British Court of Appeal, have stated that it is absolutely, absolutely unacceptable that the US executive, which means the president, should have placed these detainees beyond the rule of law. Now, as I see it, this is my view on this, that if an administration or government place a group of citizens outside and beyond the law, that means you can understand straight away the executive has placed itself above and beyond the law. And that is the issue that is before the U.S. Supreme Court now. Can the executive, under the United States Constitution, can it place itself above and beyond and outside and in violation of the United States Constitution, which in itself incorporates, although it was declared so many years ago, over 2 centuries ago, it incorporates the best elements of British justice, which was denied to the American patriots who then made a revolution. Now, we're very upset with our government, but of course we cannot be only concerned, although we must be concerned, with the British citizens who are detained there. We're concerned about the 26, to present knowledge, 26 European detainees and all other prisoners. But that's our responsibility, to be concerned with them. So on January the 20th in the House of Commons, we founded the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission, which has a number of very distinguished patrons and I have the honor to be one. And we said that we would come to Washington to place before as many of the American legislators right the way across all parties. We would seek to, for the families and their lawyers, and people like Terry Waite, who are coming on the deputation to Washington, along with Rabbi David Goldberg and one of the senior Muslim members of the British Muslim community.
Terry Waite being the former Beirut hostage.
Yes, indeed, former Beirut hostage.
Who was detained for over 1,700 days by Hezbollah.
That's right, which is over 3 years on anybody's count. Yes, so he's come to speak to the press, speak to any senator it may be possible to have access to, and to accompany our walk on Monday to the White House to hand in letters with the National Council of Churches' support to the president from the European families.
Why does he care?
Why does Terry Waite care? Well, he himself has spoken this morning. His statement's been read out in the House of Commons at our press conference, departure press conference there, which is because my brother founded the commission. I'm a co-founder. Terry Waite had a long talk with my brother. We set out to find him because we knew that what he'd suffered and the others who were detained with him in Beirut, and we wanted to ask him if he would be willing to speak up for the legal rights of those who had been detained for 2 years in Guantanamo. And he declared that he would wish to come to us with us and that he would be speaking for himself because he's not advisor to the Archbishop of Canterbury anymore, as he was at the time he was taken hostage. But we have, I ought to leave it to you to bring up the questions. Why we're coming to Washington and on Monday and Tuesday under the auspices of the American Council of Civil Liberties, the National Council of Churches of the United States, and the Center for Constitutional Rights, which, after all, certainly the National Council of Churches represents some 50 million Americans in a reflective service which has been organized by the National Council of Churches in Washington, D.C. on Monday evening at 6 o'clock. We will have speaking there certainly the families and other members of the British European deputation.
So these are European families?
Representing every, yes.
Of the detainees?
Mr. Azmat Beg, who's the father of Muazzam Beg, who's been declared that he will be sent before a military tribunal by the United States administration. The brother of Nizar Sassi, who's one of the French detainees, and a whole contingent from the, including the mayor from the French town that where they live, is coming. And also the mother of a German detainee, Mrs. Rabia Kurnaz, because her son Murat Kurnaz, a German citizen, is detained on Guantanamo. They're all coming with their lawyers. And we've worked to make this possible together with the ACLU and working with the National Council of Churches Center for Constitutional Rights, where we'll be with in New York on Wednesday evening, March the 10th.
Let me ask you, the Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, in an interview with Reuters, dismissed criticism of Pentagon's rules for planned trials for foreign terrorism suspects before U.S. military tribunals, saying the proceedings will not be a kangaroo court. Rumsfeld said the United States is a country that makes a practice of doing things in a fair and responsible way, and we will. And people will see that. And in the meantime, people will make irresponsible charges like with a kangaroo court allegation or suggestion.
Well, let's just see who Mr. Rumsfeld is designating as irresponsible in making these charges. You'll see on the front of our press release a message from the Archbishop Desmond Tutu supporting the mission of the Guantanamo Human Rights Commission and the ACLU and the National Council of Churches. We have a message from a Nobel Prize poet, Seamus Heaney. We have a message of support from Arthur Schlesinger Jr. Not only this, and that's specific, We have the British Court of Appeal, which designated it as totally unacceptable that the United States executive have placed these detainees beyond and outside the law. We have a number of US judges who, in some very important rulings in the United States, not given wide publicity, but nevertheless, it happened, stating the same, that it is unacceptable under the United States Constitution and under the whole history of United States legislation, which includes, of course, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, the judgment in San Francisco, for instance. Many U.S. judges, many U.S. lawyers have made these statements.
Could you read?
They are not irresponsible people. Would you like me to
read Desmond something? Tutu's statement?
Yes, I would like to read. The Most Reverend Desmond Tutu sent this message to us on February the 19th this year. We are appalled that revered conventions are being blatantly flouted, such as the dictum that someone is presumed innocent until proven guilty, and that everyone is entitled to legal defense of his choice, and that habeas corpus obtains. I support your efforts to ensure justice is done for your loved ones and that they will be given access to the families. God bless you.
Desmond Tutu's words.
So I suppose Mr. Rumsfeld considers Mr. Tutu, the Most Reverend Tutu, as joining the irresponsible ones. Mm. But the point is that whether someone uses the word kangaroo court or Kafkaesque court, it is not a court. In that sense, we would be saying the wrong thing. We would be helping people to understand what is not true. They are being denied access to a court, to evidence and charges being brought against them, to lawyers to represent them and to challenge the prosecution, for evidence to be thereby examined and gone through, and then either they're declared guilty and sentenced or proved innocent and freed. And you know, we in Britain have enormous experience because of the Irish issue of, and you remember the case of the Guildford Four, and they were detained, imprisoned wrongfully, and eventually, after 31 years, proved innocent, having spent 31 years, in spite of the fact that the various British governments and Crown prosecutions of that entire period knew that evidence that proved their innocence had been deliberately withheld.
Actor Vanessa Redgrave. We will continue this interview tomorrow on Democracy Now! We'll also be joined live by Asmat Beg, father of Mozan Beg, who is one of the Guantanamo detainees. Tomorrow night, Corin Redgrave, Vanessa Redgrave's brother, Asmat Beg, Michael Ratner, and a number of others, including Margaret Drabble, will be in New York at the Cooper Union Great Hall at 7 o'clock to continue this discussion of the Guantanamo detainees. And that does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Was produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, Anna Noguera, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, and John Hamilton. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer, with help from Rich Kim. Our website is democracynow.org, and you can go there to sign up for our Daily Digest as well, to get our breaking news coverage, to get the stories, the features that we're working on a daily basis, and also to link to all sorts of extended information and transcripts of today's program and every day's program. You can go there to look at our coverage, extensive coverage of what is happening in Haiti and with the Aristides. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.